Spirit Blade Underground, episode 441. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 441.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. Still Peter Franson here from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, my reactions to the Nintendo Switch event and a review of the movie Morgan, plus how Scripture both responds to our insecurity and prepares us to be transformed as we continue in the book of Ephesians. All right, lots of stuff. Let's get to it. Nice, another achievement unlocked. I bet I got more achievements than anybody I know.
Yes, sitting in front of a video game for 5 hours a day is quite an achievement.
See, this is why I don't like talking to you.
Then why don't you spend more time with real people?
Because real people don't respond to console commands.
Wow, Peter. You unlocked yet another achievement. You must have more achievements than anyone you know. Behold, you are great, and greatly to be praised.
Yeah, better. Hey guys, Peter Franson here from ChristianGeekCentral.com and Spirit Blade Productions, here with my reactions to the Nintendo Switch presentation that aired online last night, where Nintendo, for the first time, gave full details, well, arguably full, maybe not, on their new console, the Switch, which is going to be coming out March 3rd, 2017, both in the U.S. and abroad, with a retail price of $300, $299.99. They revealed a lot of interesting things. I don't think this is going to be a console for me, and yet I'm still optimistic, and I like a number of the things that they are bringing to the console market with the Switch. So let me talk just briefly about a few things. If you want like this kind of in-depth analysis and this kind of like proper coverage of the Switch, I'm not your guy for that. I'm just kind of talking about my thoughts, kind of what I reacted to, and then what I think some of the benefits are specifically for those of us who are aiming to live this life walking with Christ. And I think there are some benefits to that end that this console is providing. So let's see, we've got online with chat. They haven't had like a great online focus in the past, but Nintendo is adding online with chat, although it was unclear to me whether or not it requires like a phone app. They mentioned a phone app that you do the chatting through, but I don't know if chatting is done exclusively through that phone app or if it's actually built into the console to be able to do chat while you're playing online. So that's a bit of a mystery. There is an online paid subscription service for playing games online that will begin in the fall, and up until then, from release up until then, it's going to be a trial, kind of a trial service. And then I think with that subscription, there is a monthly download of a NES or Super NES game, which I suppose is kind of cool, but I don't remember hearing any details about what those games are, if we get to choose those games or what, you know. So I don't have a sense of the value of that yet. One thing that was cool is that there's no region locking, which means that you can buy, you know, if you speak Japanese or if the game has, you know, an English option in it, but it's maybe only being sold in Japan or something, you can buy that game from Amazon or whatever and get it shipped over here and play it here, even if it's not being sold in American retail stores. So that's a cool thing that I know a lot of hardcore gamers are excited about. It's got, when it's in its portable mode, you know, it's got multiple modes. You can It's got a dock that it normally sits in where you plug it into your TV as it's sitting in the dock. So you play it, you know, like a TV, like a normal console. It's got a portable mode where you pull it out and you take the controller that you're using and it kind of splits in half. You put those two halves on the two sides of the screen that you pull out from the dock. And now you've got this portable screen and you go seamlessly from one to the other, as you may have seen in the previous unveil video for the Switch. And then you can also set it up on a stand, like on a picnic table somewhere, take those two halves of the controller off, turn them sideways, and then you've got two teeny tiny controllers that two different people can use. And so, you know, it has a lot of flexibility in terms of how it's used. When it's on the go, it has a battery life of between 2.5 to 6 hours, which seems like a really broad range. So I'm wondering, well, what makes the difference between... You know, when you're playing a game or some kind of activity that's going to last for 2.5 hours versus what's going to last 6 hours. I don't get that. So more information on that would be great. You can wirelessly, locally link 8 of these together. So at the very least, that's going to be 8 co-op if you're all using the handheld mode. And maybe I'm not going to try and do the math, but I mean, who knows how many you can do if you take the Joy-Cons off and turn them sideways and have your little rinky-dinky controller. But there, that was cool just to kind of see this this emphasis on local multiplayer possibilities. Let's see here. The console comes with 1 or 2 Joy-Con. The way they talked about it, they always seem to use the singular, even when they were talking about it split in half. So like when it's together, the controller is called the Joy-Con. And when it's in two, it's like, these are the Joy-Con, they would say. You know, these two little, the little rinky-dink ones. So I don't know how you exactly describe maybe the right Joy-Con and the left Joy-Con or something. I don't know. But anyway, what they were kind of making a case for was that these are the game act, the console comes with two controllers. But by two controllers, they're just talking about the little, you know, rinky-dink ones that are about the size of, I think, probably an NES gamepad, maybe even smaller. And when the guy, the corporate guy in the suit, of course, when he's up there, he says, and it fits right in your hand, and it's very natural. And I was looking at his fingers, it's like, that doesn't look natural or comfortable at all. I would have to hold it in my hands. I don't know. But I don't know if I have bigger hands than normal, but I was just like, I don't know. If that looks natural to me. So anyway, jury's out on that one as far as I'm concerned. Let's see here. There was share functionality, which I don't really care about, but that allows you to share screenshots and eventually video as you're playing games, share those things online. What was interesting was that both halves of the Joy-Con have these really detailed, first they have motion control. So all the kind of Wii type of games of playing ping pong and that kind of stuff, you're still going to be able to have those types of experiences on the Switch, which was a little bit surprising to me that they were packing those into these little things. What was even maybe more surprising was that they are packing into both halves of these Joy-Con this HD rumble feature, which can is really articulated, and they were in their demonstration showing how it could simulate multiple ice cubes dropping into a glass and then that glass filling up with water, you know. So I think they were trying to convey something that really we'll only be able to get a sense of by actually getting our hands on it. So it'll be interesting to see various media outlets that get their hands on it and kind of give their commentary on the experience. I'm excited by the potential for the hardware and for the controllers, although not in their split form. I don't see myself enjoying playing a game that way. And the rumble feedback reminds me of the Steam controller's kind of precision of rumble and feedback. So that's really cool and surprising, you know. It has the ingredients in the hardware to definitely be a system that appeals in a number of ways to me, as I guess I would call myself a hardcore gamer. I don't really know how you define that these days. It is my primary hobby these days, video games. So especially the Pro Controller, I'm not sure how I'm going to feel about, the one that actually comes packed in. The Pro Controller is more like a traditional PS4 or Xbox One controller that does not split in half. It's just designed to be used as is and optimized for that kind of experience. The launch games, this is where I'm getting, this is where I'm disappointed and feeling like this is not a system for me, certainly at launch. It launches with Zelda Breath of the Wild. It doesn't come packed in. From my understanding, there are no games that come packed into this. It's the system, and then you've got to buy separately your first game to enjoy on the system. So Zelda Breath of the Wild, which has been much anticipated, is going to be coming out at launch. Also this game called 1-2 Switch, which is a party game. It's kind of like their Wii Sports, I think, where it's a game that comes packed with a bunch of mini games. And what they showed was people each one having one of the Joy-Con, a right, one having a right, one having a left, and playing games like Quick Draw, you know, cowboy type things, or Kung Fu, you know, simulations or stuff. And the idea is that you're facing not the screen, but you're facing your opponent the entire time. And it's really kind of this social gaming experience. And the screen was still there in the background, but I'm guessing it was just to kind of announce who won that round, you know, as it detects who fired their gun first or whatever. So lots of kind of mini games that just involved competitive play of some kind, or simulations of combat of some kind. So that's what 1-2 Switch seems to be all about. It's a cool direction, great for parties, I would think. But I'm thinking, how about co-op? How about co-op? That's something that I really like. Much prefer co-op over competition. And I've got two young boys. I've got a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, and they, you know, try to dominate each other plenty just naturally. I'd love to have experiences that encourage cooperation and team building together. So, but that just doesn't seem to be a real focus of Nintendo right now with the games that they're talking about for Switch. Really, they seem to be about local multiplayer, which I think is great, but they really seem to be mostly fixated on competitive multiplayer experiences. Let's see, also at launch will be Dragon Quest Heroes 1 and 2. I think 2 is the only one of those two that's going to be, like, new. Well, yeah, Dragon Quest Heroes 1 has come out. I don't know if 2 comes out on other consoles before the Switch releases. I don't know the release date for that, but anyway, those, let's see. Oh, yeah, then there's Nobunaga something or other. It's part of, a previously existing series. I Am Setsuna. There's some kind of Tetris game. Disgaea 5, which has been released before. And Super Bomberman R, which I'm not sure if that's been released before or not. I know there are titles in the series that have been released before, and that's kind of a party-type game. And that's it from all I've seen, both in the presentation and elsewhere so far, of the games that are going to be available at launch. So I'm not a particular fan of the Zelda series. I'm not really into the 1-2 Switch thing. I don't need to play Dragon Quest Heroes. I'd rather just play an actual role-playing game. I don't really know anything about Nobunaga. I already have I Am Setsuna. I don't want Tetris. I'm not interested in Disgaea or Super Bomberman. So at launch, there's really nothing in terms of games that interests me. And then a little later on in 2017, we're going to get Splatoon 2, I think, during the summer. That has a multiplayer focus, but you can play against the AI, from what I understand. So that's cool, because then we can have a potential cooperative local multiplayer experience, which would be a great thing in my house. Then there's a game called ARMS, which is, you know, another player versus player combat, but this time you're facing the screen and you're making your characters shoot these big kind of extended spring-loaded arms or whatever. It's kind of a weird, silly combat game. But again, you know, two-player PvP, you know, combat. I'm not really into that. Switch games are going to retail for $60, which means just to get the ball rolling, you're going to make an investment of $360 just to get the system in one game. The first Mario game is coming out Holiday 2017. They showed some interesting things about it. Mario's going away from the Mushroom Kingdom, and he's going to be visiting what looks like New York, or some kind of like real world city with real taxi cabs and real people walking around. It was kind of unusual. If you want to kind of build up your collection in terms of what you have available to use with this console, to get one of those Pro controllers, $70. Compared that to, I believe, the standard price for a PS4 or Xbox One controller is $50. And then if you want to get the left and right Joy-Con, you know, that basic model that can be split apart, that costs $80. And if you want just one Joy-Con, like the left Joy-Con or the right Joy-Con, those are $50 each. So holy crap. if you want anything beyond that base set, that is quite the investment. That doesn't surprise me, because as I said, the controllers sound like they're pretty technologically advanced. So, but man, for a company that's wanting to promote this kind of really multiplayer type of experience, this party type atmosphere, if you want to extend your number of players at all, you are, it is cha-ching, cha-ching, it is going to like rack up really quick. I really do like, though, this local multiplayer focus. You know, it's something that I think encourages in-person relationships and community. And I'm hoping that people will get excited about that, and that will inspire the competition, Xbox One and PS4, or even, you know, like a PC, to have more local multiplayer experiences, as opposed to these online experiences, which, while still social, it's not the same as a in-person relationship where you invite someone to come into your home. There's just something so much more personal about that kind of hanging out than there is, just being on a screen where you don't have to really be vulnerable enough to let anyone come into your space, your physical space. There's just something about that that I think is really valuable. So I love their focus on multiplayer. I think that's a great thing. I would love to see more co-op multiplayer for me personally and for my family, and for just me as a gamer and the type of games I like to play. When I do, on the rare occasion, play with other people, I prefer not online but local co-op multiplayer, and so I would love to have more of that, and just freaking more games in general. That's ultimately what this was all about to me, and I for the things I'm interested in, they just had almost nothing. Maybe nothing at all. I mean, I wanted to have the eStore showcased with a bunch of past titles from like their handheld, systems and their retro consoles and stuff, all available for purchase on their eStore. I wanted them to at least say that that will happen, but they didn't even say that will happen. They barely mentioned anything about the eStore, if at all. I can't even remember. But I'd love to see those handheld Castlevania games that were inspired by Castlevania Symphony of the Night. I'd love to see the Dragon Quest series as it was kind of remastered for those, or remade, I should say, for the handheld, the Game Boy Advance and the Nintendo DS and 3DS. I would love to hear news that those things are going to be available for purchase, at least, if not, carried over for those who already bought them digitally. I would love for something like that. That could have been a system seller for me. In fact, if they would have come out and said, at launch, we're going to have all the Game Boy Advance and DS Castlevania games available for purchase in the eShop, I would have been like, sold. That's how I want to play those games. I don't want to play them on a portable screen. I want to play them on a TV screen, and I think that would have sold me on it. But right now, this is not for me or my family anytime soon. I'll keep an eye on the games that they announce as they kind of roll out release dates and stuff. But third parties, they had some guys come in. Suits from various third-party publishers of video games, but they were very non-committal. I mean, other than saying, we like this system, we're excited about the possibilities, we're going to make something for it. Okay, well, what are you making? And sometimes they would say a title, but I mean, for me, if we remember from the Wii U, there was a similar kind of thing going on, and we saw how that panned out. There was just virtually nothing from third parties, not especially when compared to what was happening with PS4 and Xbox One. So what I really need is not suits coming out and saying what their intentions are. I need game titles and release dates. That's when I'm going to believe that, that these games are actually going to be coming out and the Switch is going to be supported by third parties. Until then, it's just not worth the financial risk for me. $300 plus 360, or who knows how much it would be if I want to play with my whole family. That's just too much for me. But I am hopeful about what their local multiplayer emphasis will do for the industry as competition, as I said, hopefully matches those efforts. More in-person relationships, for us as geeks is good, because relationships are so much of what life is in Christ and through partnership in the Holy Spirit is all about. So on that level, I tip my hat to Nintendo, and I hope that other companies will follow suit. I want to remind you guys to go check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network. If you're just listening to this podcast, you're probably missing out on some content that would really be right up your alley. Podcasts and shows like the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POS, TOS, and Helix Reviews. For more info about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com. This is my uncut review of Morgan, which just recently was released, at least on Redbox. I don't know how long it's been on Blu-ray, but the synopsis for this one reads, a corporate risk management consultant must decide whether or not to terminate an artificially created humanoid being. A few more details, there are these scientists that are working for a company, and they're kind of out in the woods at a secure location in the middle of, who knows where, and something has gone wrong with this AI, bio type of humanoid, synthetic being that they've created. It's that's resulted in someone being horribly injured, and so now the corporation that owns that facility and is paying for that project is sending in a risk management consultant to evaluate the situation and decide whether or not it's worth the program continuing given this problem that just came up. So so the movie is basically about this risk management consultant coming in and trying to assess along with the audience the nature of this humanoid-looking girlish thing that is a synthetic human of some kind, and figure out if it's going to be safe, let alone whether or not it has true feelings or whatever. I mean, those are the same kinds of questions that are, you know, being asked in this movie, but they're not the main questions. I think the main question is whether or not this thing is safe. So I found this to be a thought-provoking sci-fi suspense thriller. It has like a quiet level of tension with these bursts of shocking and brutal violence that, and the whole thing kind of builds to a really action-heavy final act with like some combat sequences that are, that I was like, wow, they're really kind of going into an action mode with this movie. I didn't quite see that coming. And as with many AI-based plots, I was trying to figure out the whole time, where does the writer stand on the issue of AI? You know, do they think that artificial intelligences have the same value as human beings, and therefore, if we get to the point of actually creating a real, you know, intelligence or whatever, that we should invest emotion in it, they should be given human rights and things like that, you know? And you can kind of get a sense of that with some stories, like, say, usually in cautionary tales or like sci-fi thrillers and stuff like that, it lands on the side of they're not really humans, there's something not right about them. Whereas like in comedies or sometimes dramas, or you know, you'll have like Short Circuit, you know, that's like heartwarming and we're supposed to feel empathy and want to, you know, invest value in this artificial intelligence. Although Short Circuit's a little bit different, arguably, because there was this kind of maybe magical bolt of lightning that gave it light life. But then you've got another character like Data in the Star Trek series that we're obviously meant to feel empathy for and see as having value on the same level that a human has value. We're obviously meant to emotionally invest in Data as a character and as a person in the same way that we would any other member of the Star Trek crew. And so you don't usually find that in, you know, in comedies and in dramas that we're supposed to look at machine, even really convincing machine life, and not emotionally invest. Usually when we're supposed to be cautious about them, it's in, you know, these kind of sci-fi thrillers. And I think that's ultimately where this one kind of lands, but they do keep kind of a tension in throughout the story. You know, there are times where I was like, oh, you know, is this thing human? Is it not? You know, and, do I feel sorry for this AI girl that's being evaluated or not? Is she just a machine or does she have a soul? And I believe that the non-physical component that humans have is a defining trait for true humanity, true personhood, as it were. But I think that if we ever cloned humans, they would very possibly have souls generated for them, as that somehow seems to happen during the biological process that we naturally use to create life. So given that a hybrid kind of part cloning and part like machine nanoparts are used to create this girl, this artificial intelligence thing, I felt it easier to consider that possibility of her being a person. Although in the end, I personally lean towards seeing her as purely a machine made of organic material, given that this story is more, I think, of a cautionary tale than a heartwarming, toaster-hugging story like, you know, Short Circuit, or, like I said, pretty much all the Data character subplots from Star Trek The Next Generation. I was riveted throughout this movie, though. It's building tension, it's intense brutality, lots of interesting questions that are being asked. It takes a direction at the end that I've seen before in AI stories, so it wasn't like, wow, that's so mind-bending or whatever, that they went in this direction or crazy or whatever. But I was just uncertain enough whether or not they would go in a given direction that they could, that I still wondered about where things were going to go toward the end, and I still enjoyed it. As far as the cast goes, I'm really going to only comment on two. The first is Kate Mara, and she's great as this tough-as-nails risk management consultant. Her performance is subtle and serious, but in a good way, and it made me always want to know more about who she was and what drove her to do the kind of work that she did. I loved watching watching her do her job with such capability and uncompromising effectiveness and dedication to her work. She was just good at what she did, you know. And at the end of the, especially a cool character in the last kind of 30 minutes, just like, dude, she's awesome, you know. Really, so I really enjoyed watching her throughout the movie. And then Anya Taylor-Joy plays Morgan, the girl thing, artificial intelligence. I never know what to call these characters, you know, because it is a girl in the sense that it's, you know, it's played by an actress, you know, but she plays Morgan with both vulnerability and like this great creep factor. And it just kept me locked on her in every scene that she was in. Really enjoyed her performance. The rest of the cast I thought was solid too. There was nobody that gave me problems or took me out of the story. Always nice to see Paul Giamatti. He was brought in to kind of do what he does, which is to kind of play the person that gets on other people's nerves. And so I always love seeing him do something other than that, and yet he's so great at it that I never object to seeing him come into a movie to do that once again. Okay, let's talk about the stunts and the visuals. The visuals are mostly about people getting brutally maimed or killed. It's not a big special effects kind of movie. And even in those instances, they often imply with sound more than they show on camera, which made me cringe even more at times. I thought they, you know, the violence was handled in a way that that wasn't like over the top, and yet at the same time, I was like, you know, as I was watching some stuff. The last 20 minutes, as I mentioned, had some great action movie kind of vibes to it, some hand-to-hand combat that I didn't expect to see in a movie like this, but it really kept me on the edge of my seat. You know, it's not a big budget movie at all, but it never feels cheap or lacking the budget that it needs to tell the story in the effective way that it intends. Okay, so I always try to ask myself, is there anything of moral, philosophical, or spiritual significance going on in the themes of this movie that might trigger worthwhile thought or conversation? And I think, yeah, as is the case with many stories that are based around the idea of artificial intelligence and its relationship to personhood or human life, I much prefer AI stories as cautionary tales. It just fits with my worldview better. In this movie, a bunch of toaster-hugging scientists totally lose objectivity and necessary caution, and they get themselves in a world of hurt because of it. We may, I don't know, I'm not a futurist, we may live to see the day when a machine or software can fool us into believing it's human, particularly if we're not looking at it, if we're interacting it through some kind of a auditory medium or like a computer medium or something like that. I think there's already been some examples where that has happened in like a text format. We can be fooled, or so I don't think we're far from that happening over the phone and maybe even in closer interactions with machines. Now, it's possible that in our lifetimes we can be flawlessly fooled into believing that a machine or software program is a human being or a person, but we need to still have some healthy caution about that, especially if we're ready at some point to pronounce such machines as persons on the same level that humans are persons. We may be able to create flawlessly convincing simulations of humanity someday, but they will still be simulations. And contrary to relativistic philosophy, reality is not defined as that which, you know, we can experience or that we interpret with our limited senses. That things can just be kind of real for us, and we perceive something as real, therefore it is real. That's a broken, self-defeating worldview, relativism is. Being fooled to think that something is a person does not objectively make that thing a person. It just makes us people who have been fooled. As believers in Jesus, Bible-believing Christians who enter into the discussion about artificial intelligence, I think we need to remember that the Bible actually reveals we have an essential non-physical component that definitively makes us who we are as humans, as persons. If we create something that does not have that component, then it's not a person, no matter how convincing that simulation might be. All right, I have no idea what your tastes are in movies, but if I were a time traveler, I would go back in time and say, Peter, consider buying this one, especially if you can get it for $12 or less. It's worth the gamble. Just buy it sight unseen, $12 or less. even knowing how this movie ends, it's still a fascinating, intense, and thought-provoking experience. So one, in other words, that you'll want to watch again, and therefore will be worth having in your library. So yeah, it's got a bit of cool, like, action movie fighting that will have you both cringing and rooting for the good guy, or good gal, I should say, at the same time. It's rated R for brutal violence and some language.
Data collection complete. Activating MusaNet 1.0.
At youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral this week, a boatload of videos. Since I can't remember if I mentioned it last week or not, I may have not, but I put up a video called Where is Carrie Fisher, which is basically in response to some of the things that have been floating around there in response to the death of Carrie Fisher, and similar to the way that there were kind of some phrases floating around when Leonard Nimoy passed away, some kind of poetic phrases in the case of Leonard Nimoy, like he's gone to the stars now, and suggestions that Carrie Fisher has, you know, become one with the Force and things like that, you know, and so it's just a moment to kind of take to first just kind of mourn the loss of Carrie Fisher, and then also to consider how we ought to be processing these kinds of things. What that video is actually is a re-edit with a new introduction and a new closing of the video that I made for Leonard Nimoy, and it's edited down and streamlined a bit so that it's just a little bit more of a smoother viewing experience, I think. So anyway, if you would find that useful or interesting, you're welcome to check that out again at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. This week, though, a bunch of stuff went up. Why I love Green Lantern and Paper and Pencil RPGs is one video, and that's actually part one of my Extra Life live stream highlights. And then also I put up part two this week because I thought, oh, this is timely. I want to get this out there before actually the Nintendo Switch event. And that is my hopes for Nintendo Switch, which just went up yesterday, I believe. And so you can kind of hear what I was thinking during the Extra Life live stream, which my thoughts really haven't changed leading up to the Nintendo event. And you know, just kind of where I was at, what I'm hoping for, and compare that to my thoughts on what was revealed. So anyway, what else? Oh, yeah. Also, my video on the Nintendo Switch event and my reactions to that and my thoughts by this time will hopefully be up by the time you're able to listen to this, as well as hopefully my review of Morgan. So a boatload of videos that is not the norm, and I'm not setting a precedent in any way. There was just, I wanted to, especially with those Extra Life videos, I realized that part two was related to the Nintendo Switch thing and that those comments and stuff and hopes would kind of be out of date and a little bit of a weird time capsule type of thing if I didn't get them up before the Nintendo Switch event. So that's why I kind of rushed getting out those first two. So anyway, there you have it. All that at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. And while you're there, if you haven't and you would like to, you can like, share, and or subscribe. Any of those things would be a wonderful way to support that channel and just kind of help spread the news about the channel and maybe point a few people to it. What else? I have all these in my script. I have all these kind of like optional things that I could say and plug and stuff. And so I'm never quite sure each time I record which thing I'm going to plug. I don't want to bore you with all this crap, guys. It's not crap, though. That's Pater, don't say that about your product. This is a fine, fine product that I'm putting together for you guys. Oh, geez. All right, that's it on that.
The truth will set you free.
The truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
All right, well, in this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of what I would call like the churchy language that we often take for granted, digging into history and languages when I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in Scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth, and I hope that you'll do that with me. It's really something that we can all do these days with the access we have to the internet and all the resources there. This time we're looking at Ephesians chapter 1, verses 20 through 23, although I'm getting a running start and actually going to read verse 19. In the ESV, it all reads, "The immeasurable greatness of his power toward us who believe, according to the working of his great might, that he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, and above every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. And he put all things under his feet and gave him as head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all." All right, well, in previous verses, Paul tells his readers that he has been ceaselessly praying for the eyes of their inward selves, you know, who we truly, truly are, not just, you know, what we affirm we believe, but like in our inward thoughts, what we really think, what we really believe, what we really trust in. Paul's been praying for the eyes of our inward selves to become enlightened, to wake up to the truth, in other words, and really see the truth so that they can understand and experience a few specific things. First, the hope that they've been called to. Second, the inheritance that they have, that we as believers are they in this instance, that we have waiting for us. And third, the power of God at work on behalf of believers in Jesus. So that's kind of what he's been wanting to emphasize and wanting to have our hearts enlightened to in the verses leading up to this. So now in verse 20, Paul now provides a prime example of God's power and might at work on behalf of believers. It was God's power that defied the natural laws of death and raised Jesus to life, something we really take for granted. But when you step back and think about, you know, people, just the natural flow of life, all the studies indicate that 10 out of 10 people die, you know? And so for someone to be raised to life and then remain alive physically, bodily, forever after that, in a perfected body, that ought to just be like stunning to us as we think about that. And that's what God's power did. It defied the natural laws of death and raised Jesus to life. It was God's power that took Jesus from a place of humiliation and presumed defeat and placed him instead at God's right hand in the heavenly places. And this seems to be an allusion to Psalm 110, verse 1, which reads, "The Lord," or Yahweh, when it's in all caps, is referring to God's personal name. "Yahweh says to my Lord," which in the lower case is almost always Adonai. "So Yahweh says to my Adonai, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." A study of the Psalms reveals some interesting patterns in relationship to the use of Yahweh, all caps L-O-R-D, and Adonai, which is capital L and then lowercase O-R-D. I recently completed studying through the Psalms with a mentor over the last 2 or 3 years it took us, and it's remarkable how the uses of Adonai slash Lord in the Psalms are connected with acts and characteristics of God revealed through Christ. Just some fascinating parallels. I think you'd be interested what you could discover the next time you read through the Psalms to just take note of what the context is around the use of capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, all caps Lord, and the uses of the lowercase version. Really interesting stuff. So in this allusion, and I think Psalm 110 verse 1 is a prime example of that, where Yahweh says to my Adonai, you know, God the Father says to Jesus. I'm not saying that Yahweh always refers specifically to the Father, but I think that's kind of what's being alluded to right here. Or Yahweh in totality says to Adonai, Jesus, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. So in this allusion, Paul is saying that God has fulfilled the prophetic vision of Psalm 110, in which Yahweh the Father has placed Yahweh Jesus, the Adonai, in ultimate authority over all creation, as God begins now the process of subduing all enemies of Jesus. All right, looking at verse 21, "The position of authority Jesus has is far above any and all other potential authorities, whether mortal authorities, you know, humans, or whether like spiritual in nature, angelic or demonic. And this authority that Jesus has will continue forever. And then verses 22 and 23, everything has been placed under the feet of Jesus. Take in that picture and its intention for a moment. it calls back again to the enemies as a footstool imagery of Psalm 110, verse 1. The power and authority of Jesus over all of creation is effortless and absolute. You know, that whole footstool image really makes that stand out to me. Evil temporarily persists, you know, we want to acknowledge that, but not in the least bit unchecked or without purpose. As we see demonstrated in the story of Joseph from Genesis 45, 5 and Genesis 50, verse 20, and in the story of Jesus' death to pay for our sins. Both instances where at the time, I'm sure, it looked like, why is God, this is totally happening unchecked. This is what is going on? Why is God allowing this? Clearly, he's just kind of like let go of the reins. But he never had. He never had. And I think those are wonderful examples of the fact that this rule that Jesus has is just absolute. It's effortless. Here's where the authority of Christ becomes relevant again to believers. God gave Jesus, as the unstoppable ruler over all things, he gave this unstoppable ruler to the church, which functions as his body and serves his agenda. And he gave to us as the church Jesus as our manager, as our ruler, as our leader. And this means that as we get on the same page with Jesus and serve his agenda, we are backed up by his unstoppable rule, by his unthwartable orchestration of events. The nature of God's rule is just kind of mind-blowing. I mean, when things go bad in our lives, or even on like a global level, he isn't off somewhere saying, well, we lost that battle, but hang in there, we're going to win the war. No, his victory and rule over everything isn't just some future hope. It's actually being carried out right now. He's not waiting to rule in the, you know, all this mess. He is ruling this mess. He's allowing evil in the equation for now and is utilizing evil choices and broken conditions common to the world to bring about wonderful things that would otherwise not be possible. The stories of Joseph and the cross are not these isolated incidents, I'm convinced, where God somehow managed to make lemonade out of lemons. No, they were the norm for how God operates in his rule of this currently fallen creation. So when things seem to go wrong or fall short of our hopes as we're serving Christ, we can celebrate the fact that his rule is just different from what we think of as rule. You know, what we perceive as failure or shortcoming is either because what we were aiming for is not truly God's agenda, and we just need to correct course, like, oh, okay, I misunderstood some of the finer details of what God was, you know, what God was pointing me here. I missed something, so I just need to correct my course, you know. Or it's because he is expertly using that perceived failure to bring about something better. Above my computer monitor, I've mentioned this before, I'm pretty sure, and also on my office door, I have posted the following phrase and verses. The phrase that I wrote is, things, quote, go different, unquote, more often than they, quote, go wrong, unquote. And then below that, I have written Proverbs 19:21 in the ESV, many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of Yahweh that will stand. And Romans 8:28 in the ESV, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. We have expectations and measures of success that often just don't match up with what God is doing. Recognizing that and submitting to a recognition of his present rule both takes pressure off our activities and gives us reason to gratefully celebrate even in the midst of difficulty or disappointment. So what's in all this for geeks? The insecurity felt by many geeks, certainly including myself, often leads us to a desire for control. Is that something you can relate to? Just kind of wanting things to be a certain way? and sometimes that's because, you know, we have like a certain value system that we're adhering to, but sometimes if we really tear apart and, you know, nitpick our own little value system, we realize, you know what, a good chunk of this is just about my comfort. You know, we can be very particular also about who we spend time with and what activities we participate in so we can remain comfortable or be seen in a favorable light. We like to control our circumstances to play up our strengths, you know, when we're around others. I think we're also susceptible to imagining a sort of heroic significance for ourselves when compared to others. Whether that's on a big scale, like you have big dreams and you're like, I'm going to be a significant big YouTuber, you know, or maybe it's something much smaller. It's just like, you know, in this small social circle, I'm the blank guy, that this is, you know, my defining strength, you know, and I'm here to help other people that fall short of how good I am in this area, you know, or whatever. I mean, we can have all these kinds of like self-elevating thoughts that are a result of our insecurity, or that come from a desire of control or whatever. You know, we can assign this purpose to ourselves that may or may not be what God actually intends, even though we may believe with certainty that it is God's intention for us. I've certainly been there before. I have, over the course of my life, especially leading up to Spirit Blade Productions, I've had God just kind of yank the wheel in a different direction when I thought for sure, I was like, I am doing what God made me to do, you know? And so I try to keep a much more loose grip on the wheel these days. So anyway, you know, we'll have this kind of idea in our minds of what God intends for us, and then we fixate on that purpose and attach a goal that will indicate success to us. But when we don't reach that goal, we become angry or bitter or maybe depressed. Or if we do reach that goal, we can miss the fact that we have insensitively kind of steamrolled over people in the process in ways that we didn't even notice at the time. The reality is that, you know, we are not in control of most things. And so that's not something that we should really be pursuing, even as we think that God is calling me to this, you know, okay, absolutely pursue that until, you know, you get some sense or better understanding of what you should be doing and maybe change course or whatever, you know, go in that direction. Absolutely. But I mean, that whole death grip that we can have on this vision that we think we've been given or that we have been given, you know, we're not really in control enough to bring that about and really be responsible for bringing that about. You know, we have our individual choices that we're responsible for, but the results depend on countless external variables. And so clinging to the hope or expectation of having control is both futile and works against what God wants to do in us, in our character, and how he wants to change us. And then following that, what he wants to do through us to bless and serve other people. In upcoming chapters, Paul will begin to describe how God wants to transform and use us as believers in community with other believers. But for us to be open and available for that transformation, we need to know and remember a few things that I think these verses are highlighting. One, that God powerfully rules over everything. Two, Christ exercises that power as the leader of the universal church, which functions as his body in the world, as it were. And number three, we were made to represent Christ as a community of Christ-empowered believers. Now, there's going to be snags and problems as we serve his purposes, so to experience what God has for us, we need to remember that success and security are defined by willing submission to God's rule and partnership with the Holy Spirit on a moment-by-moment basis.
Incoming transmission.
Tim O'Donnell writes, I had some feedback on the last podcast I listened to, the Rogue One episode. I am totally on board with the idea of doing Proverbs next. It's among one of my favorite books of the Bible. I am also pretty familiar with the book. It was one of the few book-specific Bible college classes I had. For example, did you know that there are 7 different words for wisdom in Hebrew, and all 7 of them are used in Proverbs chapter 1. Each of them pertain to a different type or use of wisdom. It was one of my favorite classes. I definitely like to go through it again for myself along with the podcast. Also, I've really been enjoying the last few In Search of Truth segments, including all the rabbit trails, especially the insistence on a Bible-based church and the importance of forming relationships. I spent a long time in a church growing up where I wasn't really challenged to form relationships because I had grown up
with most of these people. After I got married and switched churches to a place where I knew no one, I found that my relationship with Christ deepened and grew at a rate I hadn't seen in 25 years at my previous church. I have been in ministry in both churches and also saw a radical difference in the way I ministered and my perspective on what ministry is. So thank you for all you are doing with the podcast. Keep it up, and I'm looking forward to what is to come in 2017. Thank you very much for that, Tim. All right, guys, feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? I got one of those. We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we can, but we have to hear from you to do that. You can send me an email or an audio file recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. I don't think I've mentioned this yet, but I want to recommend that you guys check out the Stranger Themes podcast. It's a discussion show about the hit Netflix series Stranger Things. The podcast, I've not listened to the podcast because I haven't watched the show. I don't have Netflix. So if I ever get Netflix and watch the show, then this is something I'm definitely going to want to check out. But the reason I recommend it is because the podcast features longtime CGC community members John Wilkerson and Winston Crutchfield, which is a really cool combo for a podcast, guys. These are two guys with great, solid heads on their shoulders, who I've personally seen to be wise and in authentic, humble pursuit of life with the Holy Spirit. I can only imagine that anything that they are teaming up to create is going to be really solid stuff. You can check out the podcast at StrangerThemes.com. StrangerThemes.com. All right, guys. Well, stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it... Oh, crap. I didn't update my notes. Hang on a second. Okay, so this is a little bit of a, not sure exactly. I'm going to try and see The Resurrection of Gavin Stone, which normally I would not do. Every once in a while I'll make an exception for some kind of like a Christian movie that isn't like specifically geek in its genre. And that would be the case with The Resurrection of Gavin Stone. The reason I'm considering making an exception for this is because the trailer, I was like, this looks like maybe one of the best trailers for a Christian movie I've ever seen. It just looks like the humor, the way, the direction they're going. There's a few things in the trailer that weren't working for me, but I was like, this still seems like maybe it will be a significant step in a good in the right direction for Christian movies in terms of their quality. So just for the sake of kind of like keeping my finger on the pulse of that whole movement in the Christian cinema, I'm thinking of seeing that and kind of giving my thoughts on it. But it's also just a limited release, so I don't know if my theater's going to get it. So maybe in place of that or along with that, I might be talking about 2016 kind of in review movies and video games and stuff. And then I'm hoping to also share a speculative faith segment with you guys. So things are a little bit up in the air. But I'll still be here, I'll still be blabbing, and so if that is worth anything to you, that'll still be here. Anyways, till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you guys. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week, and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampton with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Coming through the wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
And we have just finished the two-parter episode, a landmark one for Star Trek, The Maquis, which introduced The Maquis. it begins when a Cardassian ship is at Deep Space Nine, and it's traveling, and right as it's leaving, it blows up. So we've had a terrible accident, and after they investigate, they find out It was a terrorist attack with Federation technology. And then we learn more. Apparently, there has been these series of border wars with the Cardassians for a while, and that has recently come to an end. And there has been a peace treaty. And this peace treaty, as you would imagine many peace treaties do, right on the border, there's been some swapping of territories to make the line simpler. Things like that. So what used to be a Federation colony is now a Cardassian colony. What used to be Cardassian is Federation. All right, well, that part makes sense. Treaties will do that, and the people in those areas will get screwed over, as these people did. Well, apparently, and this was all talked about after the fact, so we didn't actually see this, apparently several of the Federation people chose not to leave because they didn't want to leave the land that's been their home for decades, which is understandable. But what's weird is they didn't renounce their Federation citizenship. So that would be like if we cede Alaska to Canada, and Canada gives us, Quebec, and so the people who choose to stay and not leave to go back to their original governments are still citizens of that original government. You would think they would suddenly change to the new government. That's the weird part. But that's the crux of it. And then several people here claim that the Cardassians are waging war on them and are fighting back and escalating things. And they're sort of running their own private war, even though they're Federation citizens, which is endangering the treaty. And most of this episode is back and forth to discover these things. So I've kind of ruined the point of the episode. But then again, this is really not so much about the episode, as what Kim and I are going to discuss. This is the foundation of Voyager. If you remember when I did a summary of Voyager, I mentioned that there are two factions that are on the ship. And one faction is Maquis, and the other are the Starfleet people who are hunting them down and when they both got beamed to the other side of the galaxy. And what's really sad is Voyager barely ever used the Maquis situation they set up, and that was the whole reason they made this episode. And on Next Generation, they were dealing with the Maquis. And really, I think Next Generation and Deep Space Nine did more with the Maquis than the show that for which it was made.
Yeah. Voyager really squandered the potential that was given them here. Now, I do like, one of the things I like about this episode is I like the fact that, essentially, our heroes lose.
Well, they kind of lose, they kind of win.
From the start of this, Sisko's goal is to prevent war from re-breaking out. To prevent hostility.
Well, he does prevent he does prevent it from escalating into Federation versus Cardassians.
Yeah, he does stop it from being an out-and-out Feds versus Cardis war.
Clearly the Maquis are going to keep doing, and they do.
Skirmishes will continue. And I like that there's no easy pat answer. It's not your usual Star Trek, well, let's all sit down and talk about our differences and sing Kumbaya, and it'll all be okay.
Well, and that's Deep Space Nine in a nutshell, is there will be repercussions for this.
And that's the thing, is, you know, this will come back to bite us in the bum in the future. And like you said, I like that there's repercussions. I like that this is a dilemma where you can see both sides of the issue. You can understand why the colonists are hopping mad, and you can also understand why the Cardassians are frustrated.
Well, and that's the thing, is I do like it's a good and complex issue where both sides have a reason to make their claim, but what's bad is there's a lot of contrivance. Like I said, it's the citizenship. If the place you're in is suddenly technically Mexican ground, why are you not a Mexican citizen if you choose to live there? That's the part that doesn't make sense to me. Because the crux of this is they have to be Federation citizens, or else the Federation won't get pulled into this. Then there would just be an internal uprising that the Cardassians would have to put down.
Well, and that's not even getting into the whole treaty seems very
wrong-headed.
It seems like the Federation just basically rolled over and showed their belly and really screwed over their colonists.
Well, here, let's do a quick argument. The pro-Maquis argument is interesting. That argument is basically, we were living our lives, but because of a piece of paper that a bunch of people literally millions of miles away, if not billions of miles away, probably billions, in other words, just like infinitely far away, they looked on a map, wanted to change the lines for the sake of their treaty, their piece of paper, and so my life is going to be destroyed. Now, to the Federation's credit, the Federation did offer to relocate them, to somewhere else. So they weren't stuck with this. They chose to stay. But still, what they're basically saying is, we few are being sacrificed for the many. And that's a very offensive thing. And especially if you have that, you know, what we were talking about before is, if you're a colonist settling a new world, you're going to have very much this attitude, much like you see in America, especially in the Western America.
Yeah, the sort of person that's going to volunteer to be sent to an uninhabited planet and hack a home out of the wilderness is probably going to be a rather stubborn sort of person.
Yeah, very independent. Individuals come before the state.
They're
kind of
not going to like being told what to do.
And I can understand that. I can sympathize with that, because really the Federation is asking these people to give up everything to make other people happy, when really the Federation should be trying to do something else. They should be trying to keep those planets and figure out another, you know. On the pro-Federation side of this is, again, we finally found peace. We broke up. Now, granted, this was not a full-scale war like you'll see with the Dominion eventually, but these were some ugly border skirmishes, and as we've heard stories with O'Brien, they got really, really ugly. The kind of thing that, you know, yeah, you call it a minor skirmish no one will care about, but when you're down in that battle, it's the most horrific thing you've lived through. Just because it's not going to tear in history doesn't mean it's not terrible to live through. And so that's been going on. The Federation finally found a way to bring this to peace, to talk with them at the negotiating table instead of trying to conquer them. And, you know, you finally got your peace. But then these people who you said, do you want to move? And they said, no, we want to stay here. Said, fine, then go ahead and stay there. And then they start causing trouble. And they keep wanting to escalate everything. And they won't do anything to help. They'll only make things worse.
Rebuttal on that would be that, much like Quark talks about in this episode, I think the Federation wanted peace so much, which is the Federation's standard operating procedure.
They
prefer peace to war, hands down. I think the Federation wanted peace so much that they paid too much for it.
Yeah.
I think that they were more concerned with getting peace than getting a good deal at the negotiating table.
Mm-hmm.
And I question whether they even actually got what they paid for, because as we learn in this episode, the Cardassians have been engaging in various aggressions and depredations against the colonies.
And that's part of the problem. We do find out that the official Cardassian government has been backing this. That this was not just the Cardassians at the colonies. The Cardassians were secretly arming them because they wanted to purge the planets of all these humans and other Federation citizens. And they wanted to do it secretly so it wouldn't lead to war. Because the Cardassians don't want the war either. They want peace, but they want peace on their terms. And so it's very ugly, and it should be. As far as the performances, good performances all around.
Oh, yeah, there's a guest star who's an old friend of Sisko's, and he's a very personable character.
They have good chemistry.
Yeah.
The only thing I really regret is, and it could have been this actor, is, man, how much better would it have been if this guy was Chakotay? Because Chakotay was supposed to be a legendary Starfleet guy that everyone respected and admired. He had a reputation. He had a personal stake, and then he left Starfleet to join the Maquis, which is what this guy does. He ends up being the Maquis' leader and founder. And this would have been a great way to set up Chakotay as a character. And we never see this guy, Cal Hudson, we never see him again. He's referenced later on, but we never see him again. And so it's really a shame that they didn't just write this character as Chakotay, so that there would actually be a connection, or at least to have Chakotay there. I'm guessing they didn't have the part cast, or maybe even not the part written.
We've also got the lady playing the female Vulcan isn't too bad.
Yeah, we have a good female Vulcan
she's part of a very interesting kind of subplot with Quark.
Yeah.
I really like the chemistry the two of them have going on. And Quark gets to render a Vulcan speechless.
With logic.
Yeah.
And he's right, because, well, if you watch this episode, you can watch for yourself, because I don't want to ruin it for you, but it's a good moment.
The Quark subplot is both fun and actually, surprisingly, gives you a bit to think about. It gives you some meat to chew.
And another interesting, probably unintended subplot is the good guys keep targeting the women.
Dukat punches the Vulcan.
Twice?
Yeah, two separate fights. The first person he punches out is the Vulcan.
And then later, the Maquis people, who are being shown at least somewhat sympathetically, they shoot one of the... There's three shuttles against two, so they even the odds, and they
and
take out one...
the shuttle they decide to shoot is the one that's got Dax and Kira on it. And Matt and I were just joking. It's like, who do we punch first? Punch the girl! You know, it's... Even if she's a Vulcan, she's got three times my strength, but I'm still going to hit the girl. Oh,
although,
okay.
To be fair, that you might want to take out the big target first. But, yeah, this is a two-parter. This is the first two-parter since the pilot episode. And we're actually not very far away from another two-parter. So we'll be seeing another long shawarma soon. But, yeah, this is a pretty good episode. It certainly is a critical episode. Not just for Deep Space Nine, because we'll see the Maquis again and again and again.
Yeah, you cannot afford to miss this as a turning point in Trek world building, but you really wouldn't want to, because it's a good episode anyway.
It's not a great episode, but it's a good one. It's solid. It's a very political episode. There's some action. The action is actually pretty good. Although the action is nowhere near what it's going to be very, very soon.
Yeah,
but it's pretty good action.
It's more talk than fight, but it's good talking.
Yeah, well, if you don't like talking in your stories, then Deep Space Nine is not for you.
Yeah, forget most of Star Trek if you can't stand talking.
Yeah. But yeah, I would definitely check this out. One thing I do like is the fandom is still, to this day, very strongly split over are the Maquis good or bad. And that's a good sign. It's a lot better than when they try to make something complex.
Yeah, it shows they built a realistic conflict.
Yeah, and then when you think about it, there's no real argument. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, but I know there's been things in fiction that you're supposed to wonder which side is which, but it's like everyone knows. It's like, oh yeah, well, it's this. There's no question here. And this is not like that. There, you can see both sides of it very, very well. So... we will see you next time for, what is that? The Wire. Another great episode.
Oh.
We'll get to know about Garak. We'll see you then.